We know. This is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello, and welcome to another damn fine cup of culture. Today, we are welcoming a very special guest for a very special subject. We will be discussing The Exorcist. The real one, the one from 1973, the one that even if we haven't seen it, we know all about it. So let me introduce you to Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
Hello.
It's great to be back.
It's great to have you. And joining us also is Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hi there.
Dan, you've been with us before on the June podcast. We were going to have a June podcast, but sadly it did not come to pass this time. Tell us a little bit about your podcast and the stuff that you do, just in case our listeners have forgotten.
Sure. I'm a co-host of a movie podcast called Martini Giant, which you can find at martinigiant.com. And the three of us are all from the visual effects industry. And so we have sort of a technical, highly opinionated technical view on the stuff that we review. But we cover all sorts of movies. And I myself, I'm a writer, and I'm very much into film my whole life. And I make little movies myself. So this is my entire conscious day is talking movies.
You will be our best special guest for The Exorcist then, because we have so much to talk about. Let's begin then with our personal sort of Exorcist experiences over time. There have been many, many cuts of the film, some shorter, some longer, some Blatty and Friedkin never seem to agree on what should definitely be in the film and what should definitely not be in the film. So I don't know, what's the first time that Sam saw The Exorcist? Do you remember?
I must have been around 13 or 14, you know, just Regan's age, pretty much, when I saw The Exorcist for the first time. We had a tendency in our family to see movies too early. And I think The Exorcist had this clout of being, you know, this movie with the girl who talks really badly and is doing all kinds of extraordinary things. And I think even before I saw it, it was legendary to my sister, my friends and I. And I must have been around that age. And then later on in my early 20s, I saw, of course, the new edit, the version you've never seen, or director's cut or whatever you want to talk it. I guess it's one of the writer's cut. And I saw the spider walk for the first time. That's the only thing I remember being different, because I guess I hadn't seen it in a while. So it was only in preparation for this podcast that I really got into the nitty-gritty details of what is in which version. For me, it was always kind of the same experience, and I've seen it maybe half a dozen to 10 times altogether.
Dan, do you remember your first Exorcist experience?
I absolutely approve of your family's seeing things too young method of filmmaking, film watching. Because I have much the same experience, because like when I was growing up, there was a great channel just outside of Boston called TV38, and they hosted a show called The Movie Loft. And The Movie Loft would show late at night double features of all sorts of, you know, incredible movie selections and stuff that you really wouldn't see on network TV at all. So I got to see way, way too young a lot of my very favorite movies, and they all share the same mental scarring ability that The Exorcist has. And so I don't remember the age I saw The Exorcist, but the first time I saw it, like, I remember I had only once or twice been as scared as that. And it was the first sort of supernatural scary that I had ever experienced. And so it opened up an entire, because like I probably talked about it before on the show, like I saw Alien, this is not my parents' fault, this is my brother's fault, when I was 8 years old. And that's the scariest thing I had ever seen. But it's also a very straightforward, there is a monster, it's real kind of frightening, right? Whereas this is so much more spiritual, I guess is the right word, you know? And it was a much, much deeper, weirder kind of horror. And it really, really served as a base for many of my interests going forward. So this is a very, very important movie in my development. Even though I saw it way too young, it created filmic and other obsessions in my mind.
Yeah, I think it's an important movie anyway. Mm-hmm. Just, I mean, what makes this movie so great? I mean, we all know Mark Kermode, who is an incredible advocate for this film. He says it's not just the greatest horror movie ever made. It is the greatest film ever made. I love a bit of hyperbole from a really enormous film fan, so I'll go with that. But guys, what makes this film so incredibly powerful?
I think that there's a combination of things that is happening in that movie that they haven't really been able to replicate since. And I think that's why it really stands out even today when you compare it to not only other horror movies, but to other dramas. Because I think that Exorcist is the reason why it works is because, like, first and foremost, it's a drama. And it's an extraordinarily successful, grown-up, real piece of work, which is just not the way that horror was treated then. And it's definitely not the way that horror is treated now. And I would say it's pretty rare to see dramas today that are as invested in, like, this particular style of American neorealism as this is. And in the context of releasing this in 1973, when, you know, it was... Like, I'm not a religious person in the slightest, but this movie works incredibly well on me. It's a scary movie. And the only the only regret I have about the movie is that I can never get as scared as people who were religious in 1973 seeing this movie, because it doesn't just, like, it deals with sort of spiritual and existential questions very, very directly and very realistically. And I mean that not in a religious way. Like, there are characters in the movie that are religious, but that is their angle on the experience. And everyone else in the movie is still having this experience, but they have no tools to interact with it. And I think that that is the real horror of the film. Like, it's not like many other horror movies, many, many other Exorcist ripoffs depend on the idea of selling you on religion in order for it to work. But what this is leveraging is real questions about your actual life and things you don't understand and the fear of coming up against stuff that you have no experience with that asks real questions of your own life. You don't have to be religious to be freaked out by the stuff that this poses. And I think that Friedkin, in that time period, especially between French Connection, this and Sorcerer, is one of the greatest film realists of all time. So I agree with, like, Kermode on, like, the, like, I wouldn't call it the best movie ever made, but it's certainly the most, like, resilient movie ever made. Like, I don't think American film has really replicated this, even in a non-horror setting.
I disagree with Kermode only in that I generally dislike bests almost as much as firsts.
Sure.
But I can see his point. Sam, what do you think makes this movie so incredibly powerful?
Well, I'm going to take one point that Kermode makes over and over again about what the movie is all about and how misunderstood it is. I think among being one of the best movies, if not the best, which I would also kind of disagree with, but I get his point. I think it's also that it's misunderstood in terms of the focus. Everyone talks about the girl, Reagan, Linda Blair. Everyone had that at the center of attention. I think it was the same for us, obviously, as children seeing it for the first time. You thought it was about this possessed girl. But then I remember picking up early on the fact that other parts were scarier or just as scary, and that this, I'm going to call it the grand guignol of the special effects of Linda Blair, was more silly and more worthwhile, you know, imitating at school, saying the same things that she says in all those scenes and laughing about it. But the truly scary bits were always somewhere else. And I picked up on that quite early. I remember seeing those early Iraq scenes, Father Karras and the mother, the house, Regan's mother just walking around in the house in the attic. Those were the truly, really, really scary bits. And I think because they're treated so sparsely in that documentary style that Friedkin has, I don't know The Sorcerer yet, but I know French Connection.
Oh, you I'm sorry to interrupt. You have a good movie coming.
I know. I'm so excited to see it, but I've yet to see it. But I think to have it in that style and then for it to be that story of The Exorcist, I think that combination is just absolutely unique and has not been able to be replicated. And I think that's the key issue that Kermode also points out so well about the film.
What's interesting for me when I rewatched this again, I've watched it many, many times, is that it changes over time. I think what makes this movie so great. When I was younger and watched this, I was all into the gross out, right? And the mechanical effects, and it was so neat and cool. And I don't even think I even registered the blasphemy of it. Just, you know, I think I just thought it was, you know, all the jump scares and that sort of stuff was really cool. And as I got older, I started identifying with different aspects of the film. So nowadays, as an adult woman, I think the worst part of the film is before Regan is properly possessed. Her journey towards when she starts calling the doctor's names, when she starts, she pees herself in the middle of a party, and you're losing her. And there's to this supernatural occult entity, and there's nothing you can do. I mean, the mother is completely, she is so frantic that she, as an agnostic or non-believer, goes to a priest, right? This is how bad it gets, is that she's grasping at straws. And that to me now is, as Sam rightly says, some of the more impactful stuff, and Dan, you said that also, is in the drama of losing this person, her autonomy, her self-control, her mind, to something that is literally out of this world, right? We are losing her to Satan in this case. And it was interesting to me, I watched a short interview with one of the priests who were on site. There were priests, there were in fact more than one. And he said, okay, I will consult on this movie to Friedkin. He said, but only if you take evil seriously. We do not want to make this a joke or some sort of bogeyman. And oh boy, did he. He takes the problem of evil very seriously in almost an agnostic way. Like, this is completely happening. We watch all these lovely scenes in Washington. It is Washington in the fall, very picturesque. These are real people, successful people, beautiful people, and this evil befalls them for basically no reason. And it's all real. And never mind if you believe in devils and whatever, or evil at all. It's still going to impact you. It's so deeply rooted in our cultural conscience, this idea of an external malevolent force. It really draws you in. So that's what makes it great to me, is that it sort of changes with the times as well as just being very good.
And just the mother-daughter relationship at the center of it, I think that works so well. I think those two are so incredibly believable in those early scenes that they share together. And they're so endearing that the change that then Regan goes through is so painful to watch on Ellen Burstyn's face and in her reactions. I mean, famously, her jump scares when she enters a room and sees something new that's happening to her in the most extreme. But it starts so subtly and it starts so early with those differences that she goes through when she, for the first time, talks to her about, oh, what's the name of it?
The Ouija board.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right. And it's just very small things in the conversation that start to somehow be at odds with what the mother thinks of her daughter. And they begin to develop into something bigger and bigger and bigger. And the changes become, of course, at the party scene become for the first time really, you know, noticeable. But they start very early in the film, I noticed this time. And I think the disintegration of this mother-daughter relationship is so heartbreaking and is then so central to our experience.
Well, I think that Burstyn's performance, to me, it's one of the great heroic performances in film, because she's not just realistic, like her performance is very believable, but her and Friedkin do the one thing you're not supposed to do in a Hollywood movie, which is to play your character so realistically that they are unpleasant to watch. Like, she is unlikable because she is terrified and furious the whole time. Like, she is so frustrated with the establishment and with the doctors and with, like, this is where people connect with the movie most directly, I think, where you don't have to be religious to know what it's like to, like, people aren't listening to me about the most important thing in my life. Like, this is my daughter, and everyone's just treating this as like a secondary problem or something that we can manage, or they think they can wrap their hands around it, and nothing of what they're doing is helping. And yet they're talking as if they know what they're doing. And the incredible frustration that she is, especially, you know, before she finally breaks and talks to the priest. Like, the movie brings you all the way through this journey where she's just like, I've had it. I've had it with everyone. You know, no one understands the suffering I'm embroiled in, and no one really wants to help me. And so she almost starts looking at everyone else as the enemy. Like, they're a greater hill to climb than anything. Like, that she has to get through that and then help her daughter is overwhelming to her. And it's something that you don't see, especially in Hollywood movies. Like, I mean, movies are so concerned with keeping your central character likable because you'll lose the audience. And in this, like, she is, like, Burstyn is just screaming at the top of her lungs, and no one's listening to her. And they bank everything on the fact that everyone has been in a position like this in their lives over something or someone, and that you will, even though it's unpleasant to see it, you will relate to it. Because this could be, you know, this could be a mother-daughter experience. This could be someone dealing with, like, whatever, their spouse has Alzheimer's, you know, like, it could be any of these kinds of things, and it would still feel exactly like this. And then structurally, what's brilliant about that is that it takes about over half of the film, almost the first two thirds of the film, before she relents and says, I have to talk to this priest. Like, it takes that much to convince her of this action. That's how little she believes in any of this mystical mumbo jumbo. And she finally hits bottom and talks to Jason Miller, Father Karras, also a great playwright. And then when she tells him this, his reaction is, this is probably not true. I don't believe in exorcisms. Like, because, like, they've built up his question of faith and his struggle with his dying mother and all this other stuff. And he's lost faith in everything. So you, the one guy you expect to be like, I'm glad you found faith in God, let's go. He's like, this is a giant mistake and it's all psychological. And she's like, oh my God. You know, but he is the one difference is that he's the only person that is listening to her. That's it. And that's when it's, that's why it's such a relief, both for her and for the audience, that there's actual communication going on. That's what gives us hope in the movie.
Yeah. And he acts on it as well. I keep being a little bit sort of, I don't want to say shocked, but surprised about the casting. Because they were going to have Jack Nicholson, I think, if memory serves. They had a couple of really big names attached to this.
Right.
And they found this theater actor, I think because Friedkin wanted a complete unknown. And he's so good in this.
Oh, he's tremendous. Yeah, Miller's tremendous in this thing. I mean, he's the sort of sympathetic anchor of the movie. Like I was saying, like, with the unlikability of Burstyn's performance is designed around the fact that she is going to meet this guy. And it's such a, you know, cold drink of water in the desert to meet him that you feel that rush of connection when they connect because you are so relieved for her. And even then, you're going in thinking, of course, he doesn't have faith in himself to do this. So, like, you feel connected, but you don't feel like, you still don't feel like there's a chance. And it's so you, like, the investment, the emotional investment in these characters goes way, way up. Because now they're up against something that's likely undefeatable, but now I care about them both because they sort of found each other as people. And now I have something as an audience member that I can lose because I love them. it's a brilliant just bit of structural design on Blatty and Friedkin's part.
It is. And that is where I agree with Blatty. There is in the longer cuts of the film, there is a dialogue on the stairs. We have so many stairs in this film. So you guys... talking about why the devil would possess this particular little girl. It doesn't make sense. And basically, the theory of the priests is that it's not about her. It's about all of us, which includes the audience. It's about us being animalistic, us having forgotten all that's holy. It's about us being demeaned, not about this little girl. And that's why I'm glad that scene made it back into the film, because it explains the ending. It explains another, that there's a human connection there that I think the film needs. Otherwise, you will go into a little bit of a hokey area. The film, without those scenes, feels a little bit chaotic. It goes from climax to climax and more screams and more scares and more invective.
Mm-hmm.
And with these quiet moments, I feel, at least, with Mr. Blatty in this case. Friedkin doesn't have a lot of patience with that sort of thing.
Right.
But I feel it anchors the film in exactly the way that you say, Dan, because it makes it human. It's not just a movie about a devil possessing a young girl and torturing her basically almost to death. Because that's not the interesting story here. I don't know, Sam, what do you think?
Yeah, and it supports Kermode's point that he makes, that it's about everybody else and not the girl. And I think it works so well because it's also prepared. It's preparing us to meet Father Marion at the beginning in a scene that we at first can't connect to the rest of the film. And then it brings us to Father Karras. And I think the relationship with his mother is so beautifully shown when he visits her at her apartment and then heartbreakingly later on at the psychiatric ward. And I think that's another really scary scene when he just tries to get to his mother and meet her at her bed, and he has to go past these other patients, and you get a sense of how lost she must feel having to leave her apartment and then being in this place that the uncle took her to because there was apparently no other option. And I think these scenes prepare us for everything that happens later, and it's the same with obviously Ellen Burstyn's character, and even with the people in the house, with Kitty Wynn and Reinhold Schindler as the people who work at the house. Somehow these characters are properly introduced. And even the lieutenant that is introduced, Kinderman, Lee J. Cobb, I mean, you know, 12 Angry Men, I made the connection only this time. It's the same guy. It's so well cast in all different smaller and bigger parts that somehow from Karras' mother to the lieutenant, from Karras himself, obviously, to the mother, and then to Regan, obviously, as well, those characters are fleshed out and they're real. And you, the horror that happens to Regan and how it affects everybody else plays out so well. I think that's why it's such a rewarding experience in the end, because it's not hollow. It's not just types that appear, like the priest and the doctor and so on. Maybe the doctors most of all. They seem, of course, like antagonists in the course of the film.
Yeah. The sciences, those are the guys who always get it wrong, right? I mean...
Exactly. And they're a group of guys who just don't get it. But I think that's the payoff of the film until the very end, that these characters are properly built up to have that impact.
I love the character of the sort of the policeman who... He keeps talking about film, right? Do you like the movies? And then at one point he asks, I think it's Karras, to go with him to Othello by Groucho Marx or something or other.
So I mean,
it's just, it's one line, and it just, and at the end as well, this is a scene, again, a controversial one, which has been cut and then put back and then cut and then put back again. At the end as well, where he asks, so the Father Dyer, I think his name is, do you like films, right? And this is again comes to the human connection that sort of anchors this. Yeah, they're great characters.
Well, yeah, I think, like, I love that Kinderman, the investigator, is so, like, he's another force of kindness in the movie when that's not what you expect from that character.
Mm.
Like, when he goes to talk to Burstyn, like, they are both thinking the obvious thing, which is, like, your daughter is connected to Burke's death. And it's just sitting there in the middle of the conversation being unsaid, and she wants to protect her daughter, so she's not, like, bringing any aspect of this up, and he wants to protect them both. Like, he's like, I don't want to just come in and wreck your life with this probable truth, and I want to be as delicate as I can in this, because it seems like you're a good person and you're going through a horrible time. And it's so much different than what the normal setup is for that character, that it makes me believe that it's possible for people even outside of this group to be good. Like, there's a possibility to be good, you know, and to be kind to one another. And it's like, with, you bring up with the doctors, like, the doctors aren't cartoon doctors. They're not like, we know better, ha 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 ha. Like, they just sound like real doctors, which can be incredibly frustrating, that they sound like real people, right? And I think that is something that gets to the heart of why this works so well, is that Friedkin, like, not only does he treat the idea of what is happening realistically, you know, like, yes, this is supernatural, but we have to treat it like it's really happening and how people would really react to it. But he gives the same, he has the same faith in the characters in the world. Like, you can't just make people into cartoons and then say, these people are real, but these people are comic books. You know, he's like, if this is going to be scary, everyone has to be realistic. Because if there's a comic book angle, that's actually going to weaken, by association, the things that aren't real in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that by paying such attention to how characters really work and how people really work in the world, all of that, all those little things, you know, just like when Kinderman's talking to Karis and he says, like, I lied. You look like Sal Mineo, you know.
Yeah. So cute.
Great moment.
It's these beautiful little moments that you're just like, everybody has something to lose here. And everyone knows that everyone has something to lose. And that's what, it doesn't matter what kind of special effects shenanigans you're involved in, if you believe it at that level.
Yeah, and that gives me a great bridge because I want to get into some of those shenanigans. What the movie is famous for, all these, I hesitate to use the word iconic, but really well-known effects. Most of the mechanical effects, these are not optical, which continues to blow my mind even now. So shall we get into some of the nitty-gritty, the spider walks, the moving beds, the torture of several actors, and so on.
Legendary ones, yeah. You know. I mean, I just mentioned at the beginning how we were talking about The Exorcist as teenagers, of course. Those were the standout scenes for us. We focused only on the shaking bed, the turning head, the crucifix,
yeah, of course.
Whatever Reagan says, the cold room, all these things. But I think it goes together with the fact that they look so great and that they were done mostly for real. But I think, Dan, you're probably more apt to tell us a little bit about how The Exorcist differs from other special effects movies of the time and since. But it seemed incredibly realistic to begin with to me.
Well, certainly, I mean, you're already, in terms of makeup, you're dealing with like one of the two best makeup people in the history of film is this guy named Dick Smith. And he's responsible for all Reagan's effects, all of like building the head that turns around, all the everything that happens to her. And also for Max von Sydow's age makeup, which is incredibly good. Like, I think that like when you know it, you can see it, but you forget about it when you're watching it entirely. Because unlike, this actually fits into what I just said, it's not cartoon old man. It's real old man. Like, von Sydow is like, he has the perfect bone structure to build. He's a very, very slender guy. So you only have to add a little bit and very, very small touches in order to make it look like he's aged. But the most important thing that he does, Dick Smith does, is that he knows that Max von Sydow is one of the world's great actors, even at that time. And the old man stuff that's going to be believable comes from his acting, not from the makeup.
Yeah, I was going to say he's fabulous.
It's really kind of shocking. And because, like, I don't know, I think he's like, Von Sydow's like 30 something in this.
Yeah, Friedkin in one of his little interviews said that we wanted him particularly, but he kept forgetting how young the guy was. Right? Yeah. And now they right. had to figure something out because this guy's way too young.
Well, I forgot how young he is, you know, at this time. I always thought Max von Sydow was already old when he played this.
Yeah.
Well,
he played but then Death I pieced it together chess. With
the Bergman he did in the 70s and the 80s. And I thought, no, he's much younger. So it's really down to the acting.
It's really shocking. Yeah, I mean, he's so great. I mean, like, he might be younger than Jason Miller, who's playing the younger priest. You know, because Miller is like in 40 or something like that in this movie. You know, he's like late 30s, you know. But von Sydow has such complete command of his presence that you don't question it at all. Like, it doesn't even come up. And like, there's nothing, like, most people when they do an old, even really good actors, when they are asked to do the old man version or the old person version, they'll be like, well, you know, I'm like this. And I'm just like, first of all, why are you now talking like you're from Kentucky? But like, von Sydow really understands it. And Dick Smith, in terms of the effects, is like, I only need the lightest touch here to sell what he's already selling. Like, I just need to cross, I just need to sort of like blend this into physical reality. And so he doesn't do very, very much. It's a very minimal makeup job, but it's the perfect makeup job. And then in terms of everything else, you know, like, he's a technical genius and he's an incredible sculptor. So he delivers these great gags. And the thing is, like, I think that, like, the head turning stuff and the pea soup stuff, and like, these are the least scary elements for me, right? But I wouldn't take them out because they're fun. Like, they know this is why you're going to the movie.
Right.
Like, they're not so, like, full of themselves to be like, no, 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 we can't have this happen. This is a serious film. They're like, no, puke in the face, pea soup, let's do this.
Yep.
This is, we're selling tickets here, you know, and he makes them so matter of fact, like these completely over the top gags. But the way that Friedkin shoots it is just like, there you go, that's what's happening. And so it both delivers the fun aspect, but it puts it in the context of realism. So it's really disorienting.
Yeah.
And so, like, this is what I always say about VFX today and in the past is like, it isn't whether or not something looks real, it's whether or not you buy it. And buying an effect is entirely about the filmmaking, not about quality of the effect. It's like, this is that when you watch Star Wars today and like the original cut of Star Wars, like, yeah, these are not. They're great for the time, but they, you know, almost any 15-year-old kid could do all this stuff in an afternoon. And it might look a little bit cleaner, you know, but it's the context that this stuff is put in, and it's the care with which the story is being told, the actors are being directed, the sound is being designed, and it's that you, as a viewer, have been put into the place where you're like, I want to buy this.
Yeah.
And you buy it. And so, like, when you look at stuff, because I won't spend too long on this, but I just saw the new Exorcist film, and I am not, I believe Kermode said this is the worst movie he's ever seen. It is not the worst movie I've ever seen. In fact, it's pretty good. Like, most of the new Exorcist movie is pretty good for 2/3 of it. And then it becomes the worst movie I've ever seen.
Oh, no.
And it's because it goes against everything that the Exorcist does right. And, like, I wouldn't say, like, the first 2/3 are anywhere near as good as The Exorcist, but they're, like, the actors are good within the context of what they're doing, plays well. It's a fun, scary movie with good acting and nice photography. And then when they get to The Exorcist business and the head-turning blah, blah, blah stuff, that's, like, they don't believe what they're doing, so I don't believe what they're doing. Like, nothing works at all. And then you go back and watch The Exorcist, and you're just, like, they aren't even doing... Like, the new Exorcist movie is trying at every turn to be like, look, there's more effects and more crazy stuff is happening. I'm like, the more you do, the less I buy. Like, it's overwhelming.
Right. I keep thinking about that. There are a couple of things that always stick out to me in this film. And one of them is the moving cabinet that sort of moves of its own accord, which is, it's not, I'm not going to say it's a simple effect because it was very hard to do, but it's not like overcomplicated. They were not overthinking this. It is a cabinet, a chest of drawers. It has to move across the room. It has to hurt someone. It, you know, bang, go for it. And they made this lovely mechanical effect. And regardless of whether you think it looks realistic or no, I'll buy that. I'll buy some telekinesis with this devil-infested house. That's fine by me. Now, the rotating head takes me out of the film for all the wrong reasons. Because I keep having some empathy with the filmmakers going like, when is the audience going to laugh? Wouldn't they have been petrified? Like, okay, if we do this, right, is this going to get a laugh? How, I mean, they must have really been pretty scared to see, okay, have we now taken this too far?
Is it a step too far? Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. And this is talking about a movie where a young girl masturbates with a crucifix, right? This is some heavy, heavy stuff that we're talking about. Is now the rotating head going to take everybody out of the... I mean, how do you judge these things, Dan?
I think that that's a brilliant example because, like, the rotating head is, like, it's such a... Like, that is, like, monster movie gag. Like, that's a silly thing to do. And it's a fun, silly thing to do.
Right.
And it's it probably works better for people in 1973 than it does for people today. However, like, it's bought so much time and so much trust with the audience by that point that I think for the most part, it just is surreal. Like, it delivers the fun aspect and is just, it's as close to over the top as the movie is willing to go. And because of all the previous scenes, I'm like, I'll allow that.
Yeah, I think it is, again, the build-up that makes it work, right? It's because I think what I thought this time is that you first hear about the bed shaking. Reagan says it to her mother, and then you see it. And she talks about Captain Howdy and you see the scenes at the doctor where they investigate her physically as well. And I think that's where most people got sick, right, when they saw the movie. It wasn't the, yeah, the monster stuff. It was apparently the first treatment that she receives.
That's
exactly
horrifying.
So I think we've been grossed out in different ways already by just imagining it in our heads and by seeing this girl being treated that way, so that these effects then are somewhat the exaggerated version of that. And maybe they're absurd, but we are already in this scared mode. We believe it. And as you said, Dan, so rightly, we buy it. As grand guignol as it is, the head turning and the pea soup, but it's there. You're in the middle of it.
Well, I think that's the thing. I agree with you that it's a risky thing to do and a very difficult. And like contextually now, it's a little harder to take seriously just because we've seen so many other, you know, off stuff and this is the kind of stuff you expect from these kinds of movies today, whatever. But it's no less a risk to do in 73 because you're crossing a reality line with the audience that could break the trust they have in the film. And I think that they're so, that they are trusting you with this absolutely ridiculous image. And I mean ridiculous bad, just sort of like, what is going on? what is happening? It's good to set that outer perimeter of what is possible film. It's the furthest the film goes and say okay, that's this, just to let you know, we can go this far, right? That is what, then your brain's like, well, if that can happen, I really don't know. There are many lesser things that I am also very afraid of that are real.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that this gets into the territory of something that I very much miss from horror film today is transgressiveness is really important to horror film. And you have to know, you have to be willing to cross a line the audience does not want to cross, even for a second. You have to be able to set up the rules with them and say all right, well, we may go this far. And then the rest of the time, the audience is afraid that they'll go that far again or farther.
Oh, yeah. How far will you go with this? I mean, that's one of those things. What makes a French New Wave, and I mean the horror New Wave.
Yeah.
Like Haute Tension, for instance.
Yeah. Martyrs.
So good.
That kind of stuff. Yeah.
It's because, no, it just went there and it's going to get worse.
Yeah.
And that's the same sense that we get in The Exorcist. Oh my word.
If this is happening now, I don't know what's going to happen later. And I don't know if I can be here for that.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it more important that then it not more happens? I think that's also the other part. Like you said, it stops at that. Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't go as far, but you keep the audience on the edge of their seats for the rest of the film.
Right.
And kind of keep the tension up.
That's the tension. You know, it's because I think about why Carpenter's The Thing works so well. Because the thing you hear in Hollywood all the time is don't show the monster. It's much scarier if you don't show the monster. Well, The Thing shows the monster pornographically all the time. It's absolutely in your face about this. Yet the movie, it works perfectly. It's one of the great horror films of all time. And it's because it understands what's actually frightening. The monster is just the threat. It's not the thing. It's not the fear. It's the threat. It's just if this happens, then this. And you go, okay, that's very, very bad. You know, but what I am actually afraid of is when they are people.
Yeah, it's us.
And it understands that we are afraid of each other.
Yeah.
That's where the terror really lives. When it's revealed, haha, he was a thing. You're like, ah, dang it. I don't want that to have happened. But the fear comes from all the other time you're spending with people that you may not be able to trust.
Right.
And this movie understands where its horror is located isn't in the gross outs. It's in the characters and what you will lose for caring about them and what they will lose for caring about each other. That's the stakes.
Right.
And what you're risking is what you're afraid of.
Right. And I think the best horror movies also have an actual point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love my slashers, but this, even though this would not be my point to make as a filmmaker, the problem of evil and how evil exists in this world and what it does to us, just it's the mere fact of it existing is a problem of metaphysics that I don't usually think about too much. But it is a point, and the film takes it very seriously. You could say the same thing about Night of the Living Dead. Right. This is also an important horror movie, which is not particularly rich in, you know, gross out jump scares, but it's, I think, a good, really one of the best good horror movie. And this film delivers that, even though it's, I don't know how many shaking beds I need to see in my life. Right. How many were there? So the mechanical effects guy, Bakutra, I think his name is, I can't read my notes. He made several different beds to shake the girl around, right? These are mechanical shaking beds. And this sort of, I love watching the film nowadays. Now I'm a little bit more sophisticated because the effects really are quite something. That is just really awesome that these contraptions work in real time. They lift the bed with weights.
It's real stagecraft. Like that's it is. Like this is, if you were seeing this on a stage, you'd be just as impressed. You'd be like, what the hell do they do this? Yeah. Like that's wild.
And Friedkin, apart from being a documentarian and a filmmaker, is also a stage director, right? Really, this stuff really suits him. And I think for our audience, I watched a documentary called The Fear of God, The Making of the Exorcist, which is a Mark Kermode documentary, which is wonderful. And it shows us a couple of the tricks behind the special effects. And I just adore that sort of thing. I mean, it's going to like going to a magic show. It's just fabulous, fabulous stuff.
Yeah, and just the fact that they also did the whole cold room thing for real, which I didn't know. I mean, you're so used to having that added after the fact these days, you know, Titanic and ever since.
And it never looks real to me in all modern effects. Like when you add breath, no, I'm just like that.
And it's the simplest thing. You think that should be the easiest thing to do digitally, but it isn't. But the fact that they had this cooled down environment that somehow also, I think, went wrong a couple of times and, you know, they must have frozen in there for quite some time.
Yeah, it was pretty, pretty dreadful because the girl is there in her nightie, right? The guys are all wearing coats and boots and she has to be there in her nightie freezing.
Covered in pea soup.
Exactly. It's a bad idea. You feel that realism for sure.
Well, I think that that, you know, Friedkin, you know, is rightly criticized for how he, you know, how driven he was in making this movie at the expense of actors' health and comfort, because he himself later on said, like, you know, I would never treat anyone like that today.
No, he shot guns on set.
Startled
people.
Right? To shock them. Right. Yeah, exactly. But it delivers the effect. Look at Ellen Burstyn's face.
Yes.
She is fabulous in those reaction shots.
She was injured. She got her back was injured when they do the thrown against the wall gag.
Yeah, right.
And like every time I see it, I'm like, yeah, I can see how she got injured. Like that is a very, very serious pull they did with the pull rig.
Yeah.
And like when it's reckless. The nicest thing you can say is that it's reckless to not tell the actor like how hard you're going to pull them. You know, like that's dangerous and irresponsible. And I think that it comes down to, I mean, I love Friedkin and I like till through the end of his life, I was like, this is one of the most fascinating people in film, like just as a person, as an artist and how he works and what he thinks about things. And I largely like, I think his decisions on set here are bad. He thinks his decisions on set are bad.
Terrible.
But what I really appreciate about him is that he's like, he is so single-minded about delivering a particular experience for the audience that's where his mistakes come in. He's not being, I don't think he was being as egotistical as even he thinks he was. I think he is possessed by the movie.
Yeah.
Like he's like, there's a movie that needs to be made here and I will stop at nothing to get at that movie. And he makes terrible mistakes in doing that, you know, in terms of
he's completely obsessed with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he and Bernstein were friends, and she said in an interview, she said, my friend Billy has become a maniac, right? Yeah.
Right.
So she sort of feels that too. It's like, okay, I love the guy, but you know,
but this is irresponsible, right?
You are going a little bit nuts now, right? Shooting guns. I mean, I would be furious.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, like Cronenberg does this on Dead Zone, but he tells everybody.
Right.
He's like, this is what we're going to do. I need Walken to jump when he has the vision. So I'm like, Chris, I'm going to take a shotgun and shoot it in the air. You just wait and we're going to film that. And Chris Walken's like, sounds good. And then they did it.
Right.
But with Burst, and they're just like, don't worry, we're just going to, you know, pull you down to the ground. Yank her as hard as you possibly can. Like, that's a bad idea, Billy.
Yeah.
But then there's the Burstyn issue, but I wonder about the Linda Blair issue, sure, as yeah. well. But I think that was also heavily discussed when the film came out and ever since. How much was she, did she have bad effects from the filming? But apparently they took very good care of her
right.
during the filming, including Ellen Burstyn, who seemed to have had a close relationship.
Yeah.
Or building that close relationship with her to be able to do those things, I guess, in the course of the filming.
Well, this is incredibly interesting because she did hurt her back quite severely. And I'm not even sure whether the damage wasn't permanent for her.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an accident which had to do with her rigging. But then when she talks about masturbating with a crucifix as a little girl, it's hilarious because she had apparently no idea what the whole scene was about.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
It was given a little sponge. Where she had to put the crucifix in and do what she did. And she had absolutely no inkling.
Yeah. In fact, well, I would say that if you really watch the film like as objectively as you can in those sequences, you can tell the actor is completely like all the shots with Linda Blair doing anything. You see her face. You can imagine these being filmed separately in a totally different context. Absolutely none of it. Like there's a body double in there. She's doing a lot of the work. Like the worst thing she has to say a bunch of nasty stuff, you know,
very nasty
stuff. And like, that's all, you know, like this is all, you know, worked out with the parents who are on set. And like, as long as everyone here is cool, then we can do this. But if anyone has a problem, then we can't. But it just shows the incredible level of craft of everybody involved. But, you know, primarily Friedkin's like able to construct something so shocking out of like, parts that when you shot them were probably not shocking to anybody, especially to Linda Blair. I think that like Linda Blair's life and career were probably negatively impacted by the success of this film. But that's a very typical child actor issue.
Yeah, I can blame Friedkin for a lot, but that's not his fault, right?
Mm-hmm.
And while we're on it, we have to talk about Mercedes McCambridge, who is... If I say she is the voice of Pazuzu, she will kill me with her mind because she says it's an entity, it's an actual full character that she created to bring this demonic character to life. She is maybe, of all the fabulous things in this film, she's maybe one of the most fabulous.
This like I always think of this, and she's in Johnny Guitar, right? She's the bad guy of Johnny Guitar.
I think so, yeah.
And she's just terrific. She's just like that. Like she should be as famous as like Grace Kelly. You know, she's like that. She's just incredible.
But then she's remembered for the voice in The Exorcist most of all.
Yeah. But she's great.
I only saw her in Airport 79, The Concorde. She plays some minor role there. But yeah, she's fantastic. And I think adding layer after layer to this film is so fascinating to me. That by adding the sound effects, the voice, the tricks, by mixing them with this documentary style filmmaking, I think that really makes The Exorcist, right? That all the stages are so expertly put together and it's never overdone, even with those few overdone effects that could be really just absurd. But I think in combination with everything else, they work so well. So it's really what filmmaking is all about, right? If you assemble the pieces properly and it has that effect, then you're there. Then you made the perfect film. And I think maybe that's why Mark Kermode says it's the best film ever made, because it uses all these techniques to perfection. That what comes out is this, and it's so impactful.
Well, it understands itself very well. I think that's really the key. Is like Friedkin's greatest work is because he is essentially a realist director, like in terms of like how he represents things is through realism. But he almost always chose to work in pretty exaggerated storytelling, you know, like To Live and Die in LA or French Connection or Sorcerer. All these movies are like, they're very pulpy, you know, they're very, very pulpy movies. And I think that he understands something. I sound like such an old man in this podcast. I apologize. But something that we don't understand as thoroughly intrinsically these days. And I mean that for everybody, not old or young, just everybody. How we interact with media today is that we look at things and ask it to be, quote, real. Everything has to have a proper organized backstory that I can look up on Wikipedia that's very well defined. And I have to, like, we get our sense of reality through lots of extra words. Just like, if there's a plot hole in Star Wars, people will attack it and then build a little defense around it, say, well, actually, on the planet Naboo, blah, 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 blah. And they go into this whole shtick. Like,
headcanon. Yeah.
Yeah, it's headcanon. Yeah. It's just the idea of canon itself is, to me, antithetical to storytelling, because stories are metaphorical. There's no such thing as canon in a poem, right? Like this is movies, no matter how real they feel, where the rubber hits the road, they may feel very realistic, but realism is a style. It is not reality.
Oh, absolutely.
The power of stories is metaphorical, and that's what Friedkin deeply understands in making this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he once, one of his quotes was, I have my finger on the pulse of America. He understood very, very, very well why certain stories work.
And I think that's why The Exorcist works as well at the time when it came out. And I think that's one of the main points that was in that book that I recently read about the legacy of The Exorcist by Nate Segaloff. He says it's also read in the 70s as parents' fears of losing their kids in the post-68 or post-60s.
This new generation, we can't understand them, that kind
yeah.
of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was a fascinating thing. So you really had the finger on the pulse about that.
And Watergate as well, we tend to forget. Mm-hmm. But the whole political establishment was, you know, losing trust by the hour. So what do you trust now, right?
And here's all these doctors, all this stuff. Like,
right.
They're useless. I'm on my own.
They may mean well, but this is the devil we're talking about.
There's
right?
real evil in the world, and nobody is prepared to face it. Here we are on the front line.
But isn't that also the reason why all the sequels have failed and are maybe doomed to fail about The Exorcist? Because, like you said, it's a poem on its own. It doesn't need any additional information about where Regan goes after this and what happens to Father Karras and Kinderman.
This is not about facts. This is about feeling, real feelings that everyone has, right? And actually, like, I would argue that Exorcist 3 works brilliant. Like, that's actually one of my very favorite horror movies. It has nothing really to do with The Exorcist, even though a lot of characters from The Exorcist are in it. But it's directed by Blatty, and Blatty, instead of realism that Friedkin uses, he uses surrealism. Like, that, and that movie, even in the real world of that movie, is a very surreal world. And so he makes everything sort of like, he makes it a contest between, let's see if I can say this properly, the frightening truth of the world and the irony with which we try to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real struggle. Like, that's a real struggle. And I think that, like, it gets at in both movies. Like, there is a, now this again, I'm not a religious person, but I think there are core spiritual aspects of just about existing that we simply don't understand at all. And that we don't understand it is something we just try to paper over every day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, let's be honest here, I'm not a religious person either. I'm not even a very superstitious one. But we all know this to be true, that we live by the grace of papering over stuff that we know to be real and that we just cannot process in our tiny little bird brains. Right?
exactly.
And it reminds me also that Blatty has said that the original Exorcist, so the seed of the, not the whole story, but the seed of the plot was actually a true story. And I think maybe that's why he went back to it. It's something that apparently sort of stuck with him so deeply that he used to make comedies. This man, I think he used to even work with Blake Edwards.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And suddenly he goes into this very deep well of occult evils possessing little kids. That's something that must have sort of struck a chord with him.
Well, I think that he is like, I think he is sort of Herzogian in the way that he looks at this stuff, right?
That is rather good. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Herzog is one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. He's a personal hero of mine in terms of filmmaking. And because of his, not just because of the quality of his movies, but because the idea that even when he's making documentaries, he intentionally includes things that are factually nonsense. Like, he puts things in that simply aren't real at all. And then he'll talk about it afterwards, like, oh, that's not real. Because he knows that what you're talking about isn't facts, it's you're talking about truth. Like, facts you can do anything with. You can lie all over the place with facts. But when you're talking about truths, it's something that everyone actually understand, regardless of context. You know, the context can change and you'll still connect with this thing that is being said. It's very difficult to find a way to say it because it's not a language thing. It's a experience thing. It's being alive in the world thing. And the only way to say this stuff is through poetry. And I feel like this is like to connect it to The Exorcist. And like, I've read great chunks of the Bible, and I think it's a fascinating and often beautiful book. Like, there's lots of interesting, you know, there's lots of nonsense in it, sure. But it largely understands that the only way to talk about the real world is through poetry. If you're really going to talk about what it's like to be alive, it's through poetry. Like, it's not through listing facts of what is literally in front of you. And people, so I'm going to try and pull this together as tightly as I can. The difference between The Exorcist and the new Exorcist movie is that one understands truth, the other only understands facts and is actually quite afraid of truth. And what I mean by that is that Exorcist is effective to non-religious people because the characters in it, including two priests, you know, who are ostensibly religious.
And they are actual real priests
in there,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like actual, like these are people that, this is how they perceive reality, right? And you have, you have Karis and you have Marin. And you watch them going through the ritual at the end. And you can see, like, they absolutely believe what they are doing. Because they know that what they are doing, like these words and all this kind of stuff, these are tools to do something that they believe in, which is saving this girl. Like, when you see the exorcism in the new Exorcist movie, all that comes off as fake because it's played like it's some sort of magic. Like, it's some external thing that we don't have access to normally. I'm just like, oh, we have to just wave our hands like this and throw things, and then somehow it'll be all right. Like, the reason why the girl is saved is because they want to save her with every ounce of their being. That's what they're there to do. Like, these are the tools they have, but they would use any tools.
Right.
This is what they really, really think is going to work, and that's how they approach it.
And in the end, of course, I don't think I'm going to spoil The Exorcist for anyone. In the end, it's the martyrdom, the self-sacrifice of this doubting Thomas, this doubting priest, which ends up saving the living girl.
You bring up brilliantly, there are a lot of stairs in this movie. Like, the best stair scene. Like, when you're at the bottom of the stairs, you're in realistic land. Like, this is Earth. And when you're at the top of the stairs, you're in a different environment.
It's almost The Shining, like, right? It's like a similar sort of trick.
Right. And so when, like, the power, like, here's something that irritated me about the new Exorcist. Is that there's a line they have, I mean, everyone knows they bring Ellen Burstyn back to this movie. Someone's like, why weren't you in the room for the exorcism? And she's like, I don't know, because the patriarchy kept me out. And I was like, that's a conversation to be had that has some truth to it, for sure. But that's not what happens in The Exorcist.
Oh, of course
it's
not.
That's absurd. That's in the actual movie.
Yeah, it's a silly point of view. Why are you coming in to make points on that? I mean, like, I agree with you, and you're wrong to say that here. Like, that doesn't make any sense in this context at all, because, the reason why she is not in the room is because she is the one who will be most emotionally affected by what is going on.
Of course, she's not a priest. She has no defenses. Right. It's ridiculous.
But what a revisionist view of The Exorcist, you know, by making this.
It's a very fashionable thing to have done.
So
and
different.
Also, if you try to bring feminism to The Exorcist, I double dare you to even try and go there. Many, many better minds than mine have failed miserably on both sides of the debate, on the side that it's an exploitative, anti-woman, misogynist piece of trash, or it's actually the liberation of God knows what. I don't even always understand. I have my own theory. But you don't do it that way. If we're going to go there, you don't do it that way, right?
It misses the point entirely. Well, I mean, like, you can stand, like, you know, I think that The Exorcist is a, I don't think it's an intentionally feminist work, but it's an example of a female lead in a 70s film that is more groundbreaking than almost any other.
Yeah, and it's not very male-gazy for a horror film, is it?
Not at all.
Exactly.
Right? So if we're going to put some sort of feminist lens on this film, you could do it sensibly You don't sort of put a throwaway line in the sequel, you guys, really. You can't do that.
It's something that, like, I think there is an interesting point to have, like, there is, in fact, that point exists in The Exorcist, in that, like, she is going up against mostly male doctors in that movie. Like, people are just like, they assume their own knowledge is correct and they're not really interested. Like, and the rest of the church is represented this way. Like, the church is concerned with how they look. Like, they don't know, man, if we start talking about exorcism, then this messes up. This is going to look bad. You know, like, there's all sorts of, you know, patriarchal elements to the movie already. That's perfectly valid.
But in the church, I mean, the church, the whole darn church is patriarchal. If you're going to put
literally.
A bunch of priests to perform an exorcism, right? These are Catholic priests. I'm sorry, but you know.
But she's so strong in it at the same time.
She's wonderful.
I mean, she's so in charge despite all the despair and the heartbreak. But
is a weakening thing to say about that character, to say that she was kept out due to the patriarchy. She is not kept out of anything in that movie. Like, if she is, people try, the patriarchy tries to keep her out of her own decision making in The Exorcist. And she's like, no, you guys don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
Like, she is like, as a person, like, the strength of the movie is her strength against this nonsense. Mm-hmm. So the reason why she is not in the room is the same reason why Maren kicks Karis out.
Right. Exactly.
Like, this thing is made of lies. And if you are emotionally open to its assault, it will do nothing but play you like a piano. Like, that's what's going to happen. And that's what's already happened to Ellen Burstyn through the entire film. Like, it's the one point of weakness that she has, is when she's in that room, she doesn't know what to do anymore, right? And
she's helpless.
You have these two guys, these two priests. They represent a powerful entity, right? Or an entity that thinks itself powerful, the church. But of the two of them, only one of them has his act together emotionally. Like, Maren is clear-minded, and he's incredibly strong-willed, and he believes in what he's doing. But he's 90 years old, and spoiler alert, it kills him. Like, he doesn't die because he fails. He dies because he's a physical being that can't take that anymore. And it falls on Karis. When the demon is saying, your mother is in here with us, Karis, right? And starts like talking in this, you know, saying all this stuff. And he screams like, you're not my mother.
Yes.
Right. Like, it's that moment when Maren's like, get out, Damien. Like, that's it. Like, there's not even no argument at all. Just get up. That's it. And he starts to try to apologize. Like, I'm so sorry. And he's like, no, I don't care. That is nothing. This isn't about you. Get out of the room. Like, that's it. And he just shoves him out. And then he goes down the stairs symbolically, like, and he's at the bottom of the stairs spiritually. And I apologize. I have such a hard time even saying this because this scene makes me so emotional. That's when Burstyn comes to him. And it's the only moment in the movie when she admits that she is powerless before this horror.
Yeah.
And says, is she going to die? Whew, gets me every time. Talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing where, for Karis, who has suffered so greatly with his mother and sense of responsibility towards her, and what this conflict has brought up for him, the fact that she trusts him that much with her greatest fear, which is identical to his greatest fear that he's already passed through, that's when he makes the decision to go back up the stairs.
Right.
That's the movie. That is the movie in a nutshell, that one little scene. And when he chooses to do that, of course, when he returns, the old priest is dead. The only person who can do this is someone who has made the decision that he just made at the bottom of the stairs.
Right.
And as a spiritual statement, that's what our responsibility is to each other.
Yeah.
Like, we're at the bottom of the stairs and we have to decide to go and do this.
Yeah.
That's why the movie is powerful. Not because of God, but because of us.
Yeah, we have to grow into better beings than we are, basically. This is what, I mean, the best characters in this film do. Burstyn, who has to be better than she is, even though she is in hysterics half the time, she has to make these really, really terrible decisions for her kid. And of course, the priest, who then has to decide, okay, this is over for you, demon. This is just not going to happen on my watch.
It's not going to happen. I have a responsibility to other human beings.
Yeah, that makes it so incredibly powerful as well. And again, you know, the way this is acted, just those small scenes. You mentioned another small scenes out on the stairs, right? Beside the famous cut one. But it's the assembly of those small moments that make the rest so impactful. Just the ending as well, I'm thinking. Those last few moments when they're out again and Regan is seemingly back to normal, or she is. That's one of those moments that also gets me every time when they drive away and it seems so matter of fact, as if that all hadn't happened. She doesn't remember, apparently. And just to think about that.
Yeah, but she has some weird feeling about it. She's like, she may not remember, like, literally what happened, but she remembers spiritually what happened for her.
Mm-hmm. Recognizing the priest's collar, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And not in terms of, like, you know, Catholicism or God or any of that stuff. But she recognizes that someone stood up for her as a person and protected her and saved her.
Yeah.
Like, that's a real human thing to be doing. And I think that, like, ultimately, that's why this movie is 50 years old now. And it still works. And it still works because it understands that the power of the film and the power of what is being done in the film has nothing to do with religion. It has nothing to do with magic from God. It has nothing to do with monsters. It has to do with people helping and trusting each other in a world in which there is evil and we can't fully understand it. And we have to help each other anyway.
Yeah.
Like, that's true even if you're a complete atheist.
But the interesting thing, I think, is if you look at the movie quite chronologically, what Karas did and who Karas is and who Regan is, they haven't in those terms even met as people, because he comes in when she's already possessed and he dies to free her of the demon, which she's now freed of. So there's this very troubled guardian angel in her life who she may not even have any concept of who that man was, right? And I think it's very sort of, it says a lot about the film that it understands this, that sometimes the greatest influences in our lives are people we may not have properly met, or people who may not even know themselves how big of an impact they've had on us. I mean, we all have our heroes. Martin Scorsese doesn't know I exist. I still think he's wonderful, right? And he's inspired me.
Has had a huge impact.
In a great many ways. No, I'm only half joking. I think this is the connection between us and may not be obvious to us ourselves, and it will still be there.
Why is there such a controversy about this final scene, by the way? As we already talked about this, you know, what happens to Karas? There apparently are people who misunderstand. They think he's being thrown out by the demon. There are just some different versions of what people think this scene is. Do you know why?
I've heard the same thing. Like, I'm confused by anyone who thinks that the demon is throwing him out the window. he is killing the demon. That's what he's doing. That's the whole idea.
He's killing himself with the demon in him. Yes. That is why the pendant falls.
But apparently it was, in terms of the cutting, there was some kind of misunderstanding of, you know, his face being possessed and then unpossessed and then what happens afterwards. Yeah, I didn't know about this, but apparently that was beyond me.
I've heard this. Yeah, I've heard this. And like, it's just something I'm like, I don't understand the argument. Just in terms of storytelling, even if the editing were completely unclear, the action is completely clear.
More than clear.
Of course. That's some headcanon, by the way.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
I know that Julie, you've heard me talk about Empire Strikes Back before. Like, Empire Strikes Back is, this is the same issue. It's like, if you take New Star Wars versus Empire Strikes Back, New Star Wars gets into all the details of midichlorians and the rules and the canon and why it all works this way. And what that is, to me, is incredibly faithless. Like, you are so desperate to believe what it's saying, but you can't. So you're trying to find more and more realism to lean on, because you don't buy initially what it's talking about, or it may not know what it's talking about to begin with in many cases. But it's just like with the Force, you know, like I was so angry at the new series of Star Wars movies, which are okay, they're fine. But like there's a one moment when, you know, you see it in the trailers, Han Solo says just like, that's not how the Force works. And I'm just like, that's not how the Force works.
let me
tell you how the Force works. The Force works like this. It's a metaphor for believing in yourself. The end.
Whoosh, whoosh, yeah.
And all you need is Alec Guinness and some John Williams force.
There you go.
To do that once, and it's impactful. It's there.
That's it. You don't need any other sell. Like, this stuff sells itself. You don't have to do anything else.
And we're sophisticated. We understand the power of myth. I mean, nobody is expecting... You mentioned the Bible earlier. Nobody is expecting Ecclesiastes to be a manual for living a proper life. Everybody understands that Beowulf is not like an autobiography. I don't see, you know, why. I mean, we live, I'm sorry to be such a cliche, but we tell ourselves stories.
Yeah.
Said Joan Didion,
yeah.
In order to live.
That's it.
We are a storytelling species. We understand this stuff.
You and I could not agree more, and I'm a giant Joan Didion fan. So that, there you go.
Oh, good.
No, but I do love the comparison with the poem as well. I think the Exorcist is a poem in filmmaking, you know, comparing to storytelling, but then saying, well, as a standalone thing of human experience that needs no other comment than what it is. I think that's probably one of the most powerful images to come out of this discussion for me today, that films that are great films are that. They don't need any addition. They just have the effect every time you watch them. And I feel this movie does that. It never seems old. It never seems as if I've seen it before. And I think maybe there was a bit of a gap now, a couple of years that I hadn't watched it. But it spoke to me in different ways than ever before, you know, when I started with a teenage perspective on it that I mentioned at the beginning. You could repeat it over and over again, and it would probably not be the same experience.
Yeah.
And there's so much to discover in the movie that, I mean, I've seen this movie a million times. But like this last time I watched it, like, I was really struck by the, I'm going to say this in a particular way, it could be literal or it could just be metaphorical, but like the story, the love story between Karis and Father Dyer.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It's extremely subtle. I mean, it could be, I mean, they could actually be a couple in the movie. Like, in the movie doesn't say either way, but it's just this unbelievable, profound understanding of one another and care for one another shown in just a couple sequences. Like, it gives you this image. It gives, like, Dyer, you know, taking off Karis's shoes when he's too drunk to get into his own bed, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I feel like I'm watching a documentary about two real people who care for each other. And all I'm getting is like 30 seconds, 40 seconds worth of film. Like, it's overwhelming when, like, a friend of mine, and I will forever, can't feel bad about it, but like, I feel bad for picking on him for this one thing. But he said this one thing after we saw Gravity. And I love Gravity. I think Gravity is a wonderful movie. And he came out of it and said, I'm sorry, I need more than my daughter died to care about a character. And I was like, no, you don't. Don't say that. Never say that. Like, you may not like this movie. That's okay. But you don't have to show me more than a glimpse of real truth between people for me to instantly, profoundly care about them. Like, that's all you ever need to show me. You don't need to give me a backstory. They don't need a giant monologue with a dolly forward onto their face. They don't need any
and
of that
some
stuff.
Some sort of focus in
yes.
there.
You right? don't have to sell me. I believe in people.
Like a man called Joe that we walk to our living lover and leave our ghostly one behind.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, The Exorcist does that brilliantly. You know, I was just thinking of that mother and daughter scene at the very beginning. Also just a few seconds and just a smile on Linda Blair's face and how they play around. You don't need more than
I'm
that,
sold.
Right?
Yeah. Like, that's all you need to do. And like, actually, if anyone wants a great example of what I'm talking about that I guarantee will hit for you, there's a movie, a British movie, I think it's called Boiling Point or something. Anyway, it's about, I think it was just made into a show. It's about a kitchen and this guy trying to run his restaurant. And there is a, like, it's running all over the place, following a bunch of characters in seemingly real time. And there's one, it's a pretty good movie. I liked it. It was fine. But they come across this one quick little connection between this woman who is making pastries and this kid who is, like, you get from context, her son, and how he is struggling with addiction. They don't explain any of this stuff. It's literally 30 seconds long, and I was crying at the end of it. They never returned to it at all. I was just like, the movie's like, that's tense, and that guy's mean, and that guy's, they need the stuff. And then here's this little scene, and you're crying. Cool. And then I was just like, whoa, that was the movie. That was the movie. Why are you running away? And The Exorcist is loaded with stuff.
I'm going to have to ask you both for some final thoughts, because we could go on for hours, and I'd love to, but I think our listeners are just about through with their commute by now. So some final thoughts, Sam.
Musically, I think the film, you know, I'm a huge film music fan, and I think The Exorcist almost works without it, even though, of course, you know, Tubular Bells is famous, and there's some great classical pieces, very modern-y classical pieces in there that work brilliantly. But what I'm fascinated by is that there was apparently attempts to have a classic score in there. Bernd Herrmann was asked to do one. Lalla Schifrin did one and was thrown out unceremoniously. And I think it speaks to the quality of the film that basically you don't need music. I now know there's quite a bit of music in there, but for the first time, I feel even if you took it out, it wouldn't lessen the impact of the film. That's my final thought.
Well, I think that's brilliant. And I think that it just speaks to the like inherent emotional success of the movie, that you don't need any extra support filmically to make it work. Like, they've already landed it, and you don't need to put frosting on top of it, you know? And off of that, I would also add, if you want some good comedy and you're not afraid of a little bit of extreme swearing, look up William Friedkin Gets Angry at Anything.
That's a good one.
Like, it's unbelievable how, like, I can only imagine him talking to Lalla Schifrin about that score. When you hear him go off on his rants, you're just like, whoa, that guy was not afraid of hurting your feelings. he could care less. But yeah, so I think he's sort of a joy just to understand as an artist. You know, he's an interesting person, and to see how his attitude affects his films and stuff like this. But if I were to say a final thought of vis-a-vis simply The Exorcist, if you're looking at any of his work, is that though I think he actually has made better movies than The Exorcist, I think there is no better example of his complete faith in human storytelling. He believes in this more than anything, and what it means, what it's for, and why we need it, and the truth that it can deliver over any set of facts, the truth behind it, and the connection that it offers us is what The Exorcist is about. And so, like, to say that The Exorcist is special not only as its own little story, but also as what film does well, this is flawless. Like, this is where Kermode comes from, I think, is like, there's probably no better example, no cleaner example of why and how film connects with us. Because what is happening in this movie is factually, patently ridiculous. And our investment is 100%. And the fact that you can have that investment in the face of spinning heads and pea soup is what you go to the movies for. Like, that is the absolute root of it. And it says something about us spiritually that we engage in film and art that way. That's how we connect to one another.
That's just perfect. Thank you so much for joining us, Dan.
Oh, thank you. This is always an incredible time. I love seeing you guys, and it's just excellent. Beautiful.
What a pleasure.
And thank you as always, Sam.
Of course. Pleasure as always.
Well, this was another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Thank you so much to our listeners, and we hope to see you again next time. Goodbye.